Welcome back to World Beat. I am George Collins. And to remind you, we are speaking with AI researcher Kathleen Semenyiu. If you haven't gotten caught up on the first two segments, I highly recommend doing so. But Kathleen, we've just left off talking about design and like who these technologies are designed by and for. And it's another case that Ruha Benjamin makes in her book where she says that in the case of AI in particular, she uses this example where AI is seen as like a neutral arbiter in a lot of ways. In the American context, we might see that for things like crime and for like digital surveillance and things like that. But she makes the case as, as you've been talking to here in our segments, that AI is very much a product of whomever is behind it. The idea that it's entirely separated from whatever human influence created it is kind of absurd on some level, is her argument. Now, you've talked about the importance of decentralized AI. Could you just offer a bit of a roadmap, what exactly that means and how that might be different from what a standard offering is?
Okay. So I think of decentralized AI as much more thoughtful. First beginning with the decentralization of teams, such that we have people who are, actually have skin in the game, building the solutions for different contexts. And by skin in the game, I mean belonging to that context or some, belonging to that context. Right. So we've seen a lot of parachute science, it's called, where, developers or researchers will take a data set about a context that they're far removed from, build a solution, and then send it to that context without ever interacting with the people or meaningfully involving them in the solution development process. So skin in the game needs to mean that you have skin in the game. I don't know how else I could put it. And it means, yes, using local people, but then also building localized solutions, right? Why do we need bigger and bigger and bigger models that attempt to solve a global problem when we know that AI is actually software or technology that can only solve very highly defined problems, right? So let's also very highly define the context within which AI is developed for and only built for that. I'm very much in support of diversifying teams, ensuring there's different opinions in the rooms. So I'd love to see more collaboration between disciplines. I'd love for us to move away from being just the techies in the room or the computer scientists in the room and meaningfully involve others in the solution development process. In language, I think that means linguists. I think that means language experts, potentially historians, people who can tell us about language, and then we can go ahead and build the tools. And I'll say I've really valued that interaction in building for Kiswahili and learning about all the dynamics from a social linguistic perspective that we need to consider when it comes to development of tools. So multidisciplinary collaboration is definitely valuable to the team. At least that's three things I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think it also means very minimal data reuse. So data development is expensive. It's time consuming. In many contexts, I know it's much easier if you don't have to do it, which is why research is typically led by the existence of data sets. And we've seen that in computer vision happen. But then I think that much more thoughtful development of AI should mean that the framing of a problem even precedes the development of a data set, right? Rather than the reverse, which is what currently happens, where data aggregators collect data and they're data hungry. So they want to learn every single thing they can even before they figure out what it is they want to do. And the intention there is this brute force mechanism that tells us all data could be valuable. You never know what you could build with it. So definitely store everything before getting into the solution development stage. I think it should be the reverse, where we think about what solution it is we want to build and what data points it is that could inform that solution before then going on to create that data set and collect only those data points rather than, again, the reverse. But then this also means less reuse of data because we're now building data sets that are for very specialized instances or use cases or solutions, such that if your solution is slightly or maybe significantly different in some way, it should mean that you can't use our data sets. And I think that's going to help mitigate some of the harms that we see and biases that are arising out of data sets that are already pre-existing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and everything you're talking about to me speaks to an approach that is not just decentralized, but also very populist in a lot of ways. And I know there's folks who don't like that word in the political context, but I think that when we think about this whole idea of data sets and solutions being driven by, in essence, ordinary people. And I say this as a contrast to the solution that's been presented, not just in tech, but even just historically for political problems, that top down seems to have been the name of the game for a long time. And certainly in the US, there's a belief that, yes, there's the whole idea of the scrappy startup, but eventually the end game for a lot of them is to get bought out and to get absorbed into a larger conglomerate by their own admission, right? That's not even spitballing. And then on the political context, I think about in the across the African continent in a variety of countries, the whole idea of if the right leader gets elected, you know, that's all we need, right? And then everything is going to come from there. And regardless of where this is applied, we've seen obvious flaws with it. What you're describing to me signals like a new way of thinking in not just approaching tech problems, but just solutions in general of why don't we listen to the people who are right down in the bushes, right? Or actually on the field who have this, this experience in front of them. And you've talked about wanting to and needing to break away from big tech in that respect. How do I put this? I guess I would say, what is the hindrance of that exactly? Because when people will look at the success and the promise of tech as a way to solve problems and open up a new century, the conversation almost always goes to those big players, you know, Facebook and Google and things like that. When we get caught up on that, what is it that we're missing exactly? And what is the, how do we shift away from that narrative, if that makes sense?
I think big tech is definitely hard to beat because of the market share they hold. Right. So I could sit here and talk about localized tech solutions and we could go ahead and build them. But then it could come down to whether when I buy a phone, it has an Android OS installed or something else. It could come down to whether when I'm looking to translate, I navigate to Google Translate or to Masakane Translate, which actually exists and has much better support for African languages. I think that the thing we'll always be fighting is the ease with which markets will reach for what is familiar. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, what's familiar is social network platforms. In some places in Africa, the internet is conflated with certain social network platforms, right? So when someone asks you, hey, do you have access to the internet? They may actually be asking you, do you have Facebook on your phone or do you have Instagram on your phone? I've been thinking lately about the fact that in a very Kenyan context right now, as a business, I think Instagram is now much more powerful than having a website. Because if I want to check out a new restaurant and I have its name, the first thing I'll go check for is whether they have an Instagram page and what the face looks like. So it's very difficult to run away from the fact that the platforms we now use that power our day-to-day conveniences are already spoken for by big tech. And it means that they have the power to roll out new technology and roll it out to a much wider market that we would have to be fighting for from scratch as the people who are building something different. In terms of how we can begin to dismantle or to think about it differently, I often think about the fact that in conversations about AI, when we talk about data, we always speak about it as something that belongs to the aggregator. So the person who has collected the data is the person who owns the data, rather than thinking about the fact that there are people who are potentially the data points in this data set. So it's really going to depend on what kind of data set it is or what it's for. But then, broadly speaking, people are a data point, and your activities on a website, those are the individual points that make up the entirety of a data set that then goes on to build some AI technology that makes big tech a lot of money. But if we can start speaking about these individual contributions as much more meaningful than we currently are made to believe, I think we'd start to make some progress. Because if you realize that you do have some control and you can actually download your data from, say, Facebook or Instagram and see what it is they know about you, I think starting to empower people to think about themselves as owners of their data is a good way to go. Mm-hmm. I recently read an article about a guy who discovered that he could actually download his data from a social networking platform and then sell it. And he actually did this for a while until whatever platform it was he was selling it on, received a report and then had to take it down because the social network had said that he's actually not allowed to do that. But then I think it signals to the fact that as individuals, we do have some power. And I think that power grows as we come together. And that may potentially be some way to think about it. So I think it's a much wider conversation about data governance. And because I work in the context of language, I think about it in terms of language communities. And language communities may be the people that speak a language, or it may be the people that come together to build a data set. So like the work we're doing with Common Voice, it's not all 200 million Kiswahili speakers that we're told now exist who are going to contribute to that data set. It may be 100,000 people. It may be 500,000 people. But then it is possible, if we wanted to track the individual contributions of all those 500,000 people, such that if I, as Kathleen, sat down and contributed to 500,000 data points out of a possible 8 million, then why can't my contribution to that data set be quantified in that manner, such that if we ever needed to make a decision about what the data set can be used for versus what it cannot be used for, I, as someone who has contributed significantly, then has a say that must be respected to a great extent, right? So I would love for us to start having conversations about data ownership and data governance. That means individuals who the data is about can start to make decisions about what can and cannot be done and realize that they can actually say no to some use cases which may be invasive or they may just not want. This is not a thing that must happen, and you know, we're just at the mercy of big tech for it to happen. I think we do have individual voices that count. And if we start to think about structures that bring those individual voices together, then data governance and that whole landscape could start to change.
You know, and something else I'm thinking about and connecting it to our early discussion about language and language as a tool of accessibility and indicating in both overt and subtle ways who this stuff is for and who it ain't, just simply put. And I think about how since technology as we know it has really exploded along the same timeline as that of globalization, that right around the time that the world was opening up, this was also the time that a lot of these companies were just shooting into the stratosphere. I think one of the effects of that is that the conversation around technology has been very global and not very decentralized in terms of these specific contexts, which by default probably means that it's spoken of in a North American and European way, but that has always been the template for the conversation. How much influence do you think it would have to begin speaking about the promise of technology in a uniquely, say, Kenyan context or Nigerian context? And language, of course, is a big part of that because it signals, oh, okay, this is for me, this ain't for me, if I can't even grasp fundamentals like we were talking about earlier. But if technology and its promise was presented in the case of Kenya, for example, and I actually think of M-Pesa, the fact that I can't remember the entrepreneur's name behind it, but my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that it was actually originally an idea that they wanted to take to, I think it was North America, and say, hey, I got this cool idea for this payment service, let's pioneer it here. For some reason, they weren't able to do that, so they decided to make it homegrown. And now, I mean, throw a rock and you can't, and you'll hit a store that's got an M-Pesa booth in it, right? Yeah. I mean, you can't miss them. And to me, that is a very interesting case study in that here was this idea, this innovation that was talked about in the colors of Kenya rather than in some kind of a global way. How could that influence decentralizing tech and encourage people to enter that space, if that makes sense?
I don't know that starting to have these conversations in Kiswahili or in a Kenyan way could have a meaningful impact. I think that one way to look at it is to just decenter English as a language and not think of that as, you know, pointing to any one language, but then, I've been working with collaboratives of writers who are creating content in Kiswahili. And we're now talking to them about the opportunities of translating the stories that they're writing to other Kenyan languages, right? So I'd like that we completely move out of considering English and all the ways that we're going to not use English and rather just build stuff for ourselves. And when I say ourselves, I of course mean a very African context. I think that in Africa, multilingualism is the default. We all certainly speak a language outside of English or French or, you know, again, whatever Western language. And so I'd love to see us start having conversations in those languages and about the stuff that we are building, right? Again, going away from how technology has been built in the West or in European settings, I'm starting to talk about the fact that, hey, we have Masakane now, and there are 40 different languages that Masakane has built translation tools for. Can we start talking about that work in all the languages that we have built these tools for, as opposed to continuing to encode this information in English, where it is, again, locked away from the people that we are working to build for and to include? And of course, it's easier said than done. But then I think the more we trust that our problems actually matter and that we can build solutions for ourselves without seeking validation that will come from also having this information in English or, you know, other Western languages, or it may be that we need it presented at certain forums or settings for the work to be credible. The more we move away from that and just center our context and what that means, I think the more we can start to make progress. it starts to matter less what is being done in English and starts to matter more what we need to do and what that means in terms of languages and, you know, what it means in terms of our people and the impacts that it has. And it's much more homegrown and less trying to keep up or catch up or, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, the last major thing I want to touch on in our time together is the intersection of politics with this emerging decentralization, because we talked about it a little bit at the beginning that, you know, during election time, everybody's fangs come out, you know, for whatever group that they're from. It's, of course, something that many in North America and Europe will know as being familiar. And like I said, I believe the 2016 election in the United States, at least for us, really blew open the many ways that a lot of these platforms are not just neutral arbiters in a lot of ways. So as I would say, what are some of the considerations there as this moves forward? Because we're talking about decentralized AI. We're talking about ways to involve people in the process of crafting solutions for issues that they see every day. In there somewhere, is there a way to help alleviate a lot of that, those real hard political tribes in that way? In that if tech is seen as more accessible, if it's something that perhaps can be not controlled, that's not the word I'm looking for, but if there's more agency for ordinary people, does that demystification have any influence on the political violence that tends to happen? I don't know if I'm asking this right, because I'm trying to kind of form what I'm trying to get at here, but I'm just thinking about how intertwined tech and politics seem to be, and that this isn't unique to any one region or country of the world. And I guess I'm just wondering how would that intersection change, whether it be for the better or for the worse, with this decentralized model? Not that that's the objective of it, but what could some of the effects be? Maybe that's a better way to phrase it.
Okay, so first, with speaking about decentralization, I'd like to emphasize the fact that I don't think that development teams or teams developing solutions that are composed of locals, let's say in this case Africans or Kenyans, developing for their local context, I don't think that'll out of the box mean that we don't have any harmful solutions. It will not mean that those people have only the best of intentions when it comes to solution building. Of course, we are all still human and motivations and incentives can vary very widely. So even in Kenya, I don't know how happy I would be with the idea of tech or AI and, you know, government using that in a political setting, because I have a huge distrust for government. And I know what these tools can do, and I certainly don't want the Kenyan government having these tools at their disposal, right? So there's a whole element there in terms of trust, at least in this particular context, where I certainly don't want my government using these technologies. End of story. But in a hypothetical world where I have much greater trust in my government and these tools are available, what's a role that they can play for good? Thinking about language in particular, you can't learn a language without picking up some parts of, again, culture or history of the people of the language, right? So I think that for language technology, if we had tools that existed that made it simple for me to get on a Duolingo or some similar platform and start learning Luo or Kikuyu and pick up aspects about these people, it then humanizes them in a way that they previously may not have been humanized for my conscious. It starts to I don't know. I'll leave it there. I think that language may be able to humanize us to each other. We may be able to get to a point where it's no longer used as a tool to alienate, right? Again, because in this context, we have used language to spread hate speech and incite and mobilize towards causing harm. So it may be that it's harder for such a reality to exist if much more knowledge of such languages exists outside of just the homogeneous language communities. But then, of course, I will go back to the fact that I don't think tribe or ethnicity is the problem in Kenya. I think it's the fact that we have a political class that wants to do everything in their power to remain in the political class. And that's going to mean that they oppress the rest of us to keep that class. And so with decentralizing technology, I would hope that we start to think about, I don't want to say decentralized government, but I don't know. I don't know what that can start to look like. Maybe building civic tech that can mean we're much less susceptible to manipulation by the political class of political systems.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a good next step. If it means that we can start having trust in our government and the processes that are in place to usher one government out and another in, I think that would be progress.
Well, what you're saying speaks to an impulse that I've seen, not just in the tech sector, but even just the simple entrepreneurial sector in many different African countries, the sentiment that, man, I know that, you know, the political class ain't going to do nothing for me, right? You know, they've only got their interests at heart or whatever it might be. And I think this is why I know we haven't talked about China at all. And that's a whole nother ball game that goes on there. But I found it very fascinating in my own report and in that of others that there is a real split between the trust in those projects, between the political class and ordinary people. That, sure, if you talk to heads of state, the whole idea that we can bring in like Huawei and that this is going to be some huge blockbuster for us, they'll sing the praises all day. And yet, at least again, from my own reporting, didn't matter if I was in the clubs in Nairobi or out in the sticks or wherever, everyone would just be like, nah, that's not happening. And it's the same type of thing. You know, I have a friend who's done reporting in Nigeria, and he says there's a very similar sentiment that the understanding is the state is not going to help me. I need to find a way to do this myself with my community. And whether that is in the AI space or if it's just in general business, this seems to me to be a real shift. Maybe it's a generational thing from the immediate post-independence sentiment, again, which seemed to hold that if we just get some of our own into government, right, then everything is going to come down from there. And now the philosophy seems to be totally different from my perspective.
I think my current generation in Africa is set on making it without government because, like you say, we have very little trust that they are out to help us or that they can in any way assist us, right? I see it in tech. I've had the sentiment shared that in Africa, you sort of have to innovate. You have to innovate basic needs. Like in places where structures work, we're innovating to make things better. But in Africa, we have to first innovate the most basic needs before we can start building new solutions, so to speak. So we sort of have to work against the inefficiencies of our local context or our local governments first before we can start, you know, competing with the rest of the world or building solutions that we can export to the rest of the world. And I think it's a pity. Increasingly, again, because like with me, technology has presented me with a way to escape the local context. I don't have to deal with the dynamics of a Kenyan workplace because I play on a much global playing field. And I think the sentiment is the same with many in my generation who have such access. We sort of have the privilege to ignore the inefficiencies of our governments. And that means that we just become disinterested in dealing with the political process or engaging with it in any way. So I don't know how this further plays out because we have little interest in getting into government and do not want to interact with government. The only place where I've seen cross-pollination between government and industry is in Rwanda, in Kigali, where you walk into a room. I attended a hackathon there, and one of the judges on the judging panel was someone very high in the ICT ministry in government, which was shocking to me because as someone in Kenya who's run events for many years, I've worked very hard to have government in the room with little success. And I witnessed sharing within the hackathon where the innovator, the person who was pitching, was actually being advised by this government person that they should have a conversation afterwards because she could connect him with, you know, XYZ department or whatever, because they're in need of such a solution. So such cross-pollination in Kigali probably means that that startup has its means. Like they've got a business deal that's probably going to mean revenue for a couple of years. But then that's hardly the case anywhere else. Everywhere else, we sort of just keep our head low, try to stay ahead of regulation, pay the tax man and keep it moving.
All red tape everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, Kathleen, I feel like we could go on for hours. As we're coming to a close here, is there anything else you want to add? And certainly, as these efforts are continuing, both with your organizations and in general, what kind of support is needed for this work?
So first, I'm going to say that having worked in AI4D for a couple of years, I attended an AI4D conference where I met someone who's worked in the development space for over 20, 25 years. And something he mentioned is that the buzz around AI4D reminded him very much of ICT4D, which for people who have been around the development space for a while, this is probably a term that's familiar to you. But I'd say ICT4D is what was the buzz 20 years ago, right? When ICT skills were heralded to be what would change Africa, would be the tech developments that would change the face of the African continent. So I would urge everyone listening to this to maybe even do some research to see what came out of ICT4D. And let's use that to extrapolate what's going to come out of AI4D. And so I would like to first leave all of us with the question, what is the purpose of development? Particularly when we now start to bring technologies into the development question, can we actually say that ICT4D attained its purpose? And what do we hope for AI4D to attain? And in 20 years, are we going to be talking about quantum 4D or, I don't know, space travel 4D, right? So something to think about. And then the second thing, what can people who would like to help do? I'd say if you have the technical skills to work in ML or AI in particular, please check out any of the organizations that I've mentioned throughout this conversation. So that's the Deep Learning in Daba, that's the Masakane. You could also check out Data Science Africa or Data Science Network. These are organizations, community-based organizations, which are building largely capacity building in Africa. So I'd say check these out. Each has varied programs and various ways that you could engage as someone skilled. That could be mentorship. It could be collaborative research or contributing to some of their work or activities in that way. If you are an individual who speaks an African language, I would urge you to create content in that language. Actually, if you're a multilingual individual and speak a language that is not considered one of the dominant ones in the world, I would urge you to create digital content in your language. It may be a blog, it may be Twitter, posts on Twitter or on Facebook. I'd encourage you to create content because, again, going back to what a colleague of mine said, that we're entering a place or an inflection point in history where if machines have not codified your language or if no digital traces of your language exist, then it's very likely that in X number of years, your language is not going to exist anymore. So I'd urge you to create digital content. And to conclude, I don't know, I'm blanking. Thank you for listening and thank you for having me, George.
Yes, thank you so much for coming and for all of your wisdom. Kathleen Semenu here on World Beat, and thank you all for tuning in. We will catch you on the next one. Ciao, baby.